From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in March of 2015 when the Department of Justice released a report on its investigations into policing and court practices in Ferguson, Missouri. According to the Washington Post, the report stated, quote, "In nearly every aspect of Ferguson's law enforcement system, African Americans are impacted a severely disproportionate amount," end quote. Here's an example. October 2012, officers pulled over an African American man claiming his passenger side brake light was broken. The driver said he had the light replaced recently, and he knew it was working. But according to the driver, an officer said, "Let's see how many tickets you're going to get." The officers ended up writing the driver a citation and wouldn't allow him to prove that his light was functioning. The driver felt like he had been racially profiled. And that is just one example of issues that public defenders and criminal defense attorneys across the country, like Danielle Ponder, well, issues they see daily. Ponder is a criminal defense attorney by day and the lead singer of Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People by night. The issues she tackles are as big as her voice. Music critic Jeff Spivak has said, quote, "Ponder's powerful, soulful R&B voice doesn't easily fit into small rooms," end quote. Well, you can hear that voice at an upcoming performance at the Little Theater called For the Love of Justice. It will explore experiences that have inspired her in her work. They relate to feminism, criminal justice, personal liberation, racial justice, and more. We're previewing that concert this hour, and we're going to discuss the kinds of experiences that have inspired it. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests who are in studio. Danielle Ponder is back here. Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People, and of course, criminal defense attorney. It's always great to have you. Thanks for being
here. Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
Also here is Marcus Cooper. He is a cyclist. He works at Park Ave Bike Shop. It's great to have you, Marcus. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
And Doug Ackley is executive director of Teen Empowerment. Doug, it's always great to have you. And for our audience who is still might not remember exactly what TE is, why don't you remind them?
Thanks, Evan. Teen Empowerment hires young people right now just in the Genesee Street area as youth organizers. It's a paid job where young people look at the issues they're facing in their community and organize events, activities, and projects to impact those issues, use their voices to speak out for justice.
Well, I want to start this hour by mentioning the fact that you know, you may be hearing a little bit of music this hour and here and there because we've got some clips, but Jeff Spivak is right. The great Jeff Spivak said Danielle Ponder's voice is hard to fit into a small room. She could choose to sing about anything. A lot of her work focuses on the kind of work that she has to do during the day as a criminal defense attorney. And Danielle, when we look at Ferguson for an example, a lot of people remember Ferguson and Michael Brown, and I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also important to remember that DOJ report that showed just the kind of impacts when someone gets pulled over, well, and we know it's disproportionately people of color pulled over for a taillight out, things like that. Then all of a sudden a citation. And then all of a sudden you lose a license. Then you can't get to work. And the spiral effect. To me, that was probably just as significant because that was a demonstration of an injustice that happens to a lot of people that a lot of people like us, like me, probably don't see or realize
every
day.
Right.
What do you think?
And so I think I always want to localize the conversation because a lot of people talk about Ferguson, they talk about Baltimore. And I would just love for the Department of Justice to come down into Rochester because we are facing those same issues. Young men of color getting multiple tickets, not even for driving a vehicle, but for riding their bicycle. So what we see is young men of color getting lots of tickets from officers and then not being able to pay those tickets and then facing jail time for driving without on a suspended license because your license has been suspended for not paying your tickets. Myself and my colleague looked at our cases last rotation, our last rotation in criminal court, and 30% of our cases was for driving without a license. So people who had multiple tickets and didn't pay those tickets. And we all know if they were not poor, they would be able to pay those tickets. So, but for the fact that they couldn't afford to pay their tickets, they are in jeopardy of going to jail, even going to prison. It can even be a felony. So we, you know, the thing that has probably just really, I'm going to say hurt me the most was a 16-year-old kid that I had maybe about 4 months ago who spent the night in jail because he didn't have a light on his bike. And just seeing this 16-year-old come out Saturday morning for arraignment and just thinking, what is going on? You know, what is happening in the city that a 16-year-old kid should be in custody overnight because he didn't have a bell on his bike? But that isn't the first time I've seen it, but that was the youngest person that I've seen stopped for no bell on their bike. So this has happened frequently in the city of Rochester, and I think most people are not aware of it.
When you think about the idea of people coming in and taking a look at Rochester, do you think from your perspective in criminal defense that would be true in most or all cities in this country?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
And do you think that that has changed at all in recent years, whether it's since Ferguson or with more of an emphasis on these conversations nationally? Has that changed at all?
I'm not sure. I think what happened in New York City with the NYCLU and looking at stop and frisk has definitely created a national conversation, as Ferguson as well. I'm not sure if it's changed. Looking from where I'm standing, I don't see much of a difference. We actually were just, a few of my colleagues were talking about how we are seeing more no bell on bikes or no light on bikes stop in our office. So I don't have the data to tell you whether or not that it whether it has changed or not. But from my viewpoint, it seems like things are still the same.
What would your, and maybe you've had conversations with police officers. I mean, is it as simple as saying, think about what you're doing, think about the kind of consequences that come forward with putting a 16-year-old in jail overnight because of no bell or no light on a bike? I mean, do you have those kinds of conversations? Do you hear from officers who would say, you know, that they understand, or are they, you know, following, they're following the law to the letter? I mean, what are the kinds of conversations you have?
So let me just kind of expand on the 16-year-old that have a light on his bike. I did have the opportunity to speak to his mother, and his mother said that he said a swear word to the officer. So that's what led to him spending the night in jail. The biggest thing that I see is that the inability to de-escalate from the Rochester Police Department. A 16-year-old uses a swear word against you, which actually is not a crime, not illegal, and your reaction is to arrest him for a vehicle and traffic offense and have him spend the night in jail. And I just was watching a body cam the other day where an officer is following a young person who's being mouthy, because young people can be mouthy, following him, and almost the officer is acting like he's also 16. And the two of them are going back and forth. And it just always shocked me. Why aren't you just walking away at this point? Because this person is doing nothing criminal. Having an attitude is not criminal. But I really believe they see African-American youth and Latino youth as inherently criminal. So talking back to them all of a sudden becomes a crime. A lot of the charges that we see in court, disorderly conducts or obstructing governmental administration, typically involve giving an attitude to an officer. And we don't live in a country where we say to our young people, if you give an attitude to an officer, you'll be arrested. That's not, you know, it's not illegal to have an attitude. So I think the inability to de-escalate seems to be one of the biggest problems. It seems that once officers become involved, situations escalate. And I think there has to be better training on how to defuse a situation.
If I could say too, Evan,
we
do a lot of work with young people and officers in dialogues. And so we hear a lot of this stuff on a regular basis. And I think that we see a wide range of officers. We see them right outside on Genesee Street. And I've seen some amazing interactions take place, and I've seen some horrible interactions take place. And I do think what Danielle's saying is true. I think there's a piece of pride that's really hard to let go of, even for the adults. Like one of the things that officers say almost right off the bat when we start talking about issues, you know, between youth and police, is they'll say, well, if you give me respect, I'll give you respect. And I have to reframe that conversation, because as a taxpayer, as a citizen, as an adult who's in a position with young people all the time where I might be challenged, and we know some of the behaviors that teenagers display just on a regular basis. I have a teenage daughter. I'm going through it right now with her. And so I understand that. But if the adults don't take a role of showing respect and leading respect and modeling what needs to take place regardless of what comes at you, then I think that we're in a really bad place. But I think it's really easy for the adults, teachers and officers and administrators oftentimes, but we're talking about officers here, to de-escalate those situations instead of engaging in them.
Okay, and I think what I'm hearing from Danielle is also the point that says, you know, even if whoever the officer is dealing with doesn't really de-escalate or continues to be mouthy, that does not give an officer license to, or maybe what you're saying is that they should treat people based on a crime or not a crime committed, not based on do you have an attitude or not an attitude. Is that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's just actually the law.
Okay. Now, Danielle, I know you've heard this many times. I want to ask you, one of the things that we hear often is this idea that everybody, regardless of our backgrounds, is told, if you're dealing with an officer, show respect, say yes, sir, yes, ma'am, do what they ask you, and things will go better for you. What do you say when you hear that advice given?
I say Philando Castile, who says to an officer, officer, just to let you know, I'm a licensed gun owner and I have a gun, and who is dead right now and killed in front of his daughter and in front of his girlfriend at the time. So we have seen situations like this where there has been no attitude whatsoever, and that person is still, life was taken away. So one thing I will say is I will always tell young people, when you're stopped by an officer, be respectful. I mean, that's just, you know, something that I'm not going to tell a young person, well, you know, you can say F you to a cop and it's, you know, not illegal. I'm going to advise them that you be respectful to officers. But we do know that whether you're being respectful or not does not mean that you won't be killed by an officer, right? Or does it mean that you won't be harassed? I've had clients who were respectful, who were compliant, and still ended up in terrible situations. So I think it, you know, it depends on the officer. It depends on the context of the situation. But Philando Castile always reminds me that even when you are compliant and even when you are respectful, you could end up killed in front of your child and her mother.
Well, before I get to our first phone call on this, and we're going to hear Marcus's story in just a moment here, you brought up Philando Castile, and that, of course, was a case in Minnesota. Just for, I'm sure most listeners do remember, but it was a man who was licensed to have a firearm on him, and simply out of courtesy to the police officer during a traffic stop, told him, and within seconds, seven shots were fired into the car, and he died. Mm-hmm. I have seen nothing that could possibly convince me that that wasn't a shocking and awful and tragic result. Nothing that any, the officer had some bizarre story about having smelled marijuana in the car and thought, well, there's a kid in the car and maybe he doesn't have respect for life and maybe he won't respect my life and maybe he's going to pull that gun on me. I mean, that is a jump to a jump to a jump in logic. This past political campaign, we had a sheriff's race. I asked the current incumbent sheriff, Patrick O'Flynn, what he thought of that case, and he said he wasn't really familiar with it. Mm-hmm. And the incoming sheriff, Todd Baxter, who's been very generous with his time, and I always appreciate that, told me that, you know, he thinks it was an issue of training, that he wants to know what was the actual training that led to someone being that scared in that moment, and that he would want to pull it back that way. But Sheriff O'Flynn said he wasn't really familiar. Is it acceptable to you that someone in law enforcement would not be familiar with a case like that?
I think it's completely unacceptable.
Agreed.
but I think that our, you know, our cries and our concern and our pain are constantly not heard, right? And so I think that's why the rallying cry of the movement is Black Lives Matter. It's because for someone who's, you know, going to be sheriff or sheriff of the county to not have any knowledge of that. I mean, myself and my African-American coworkers the next day in work were just completely it's almost traumatizing every time you see a new video or you, you know, read a new article. So just going through immense pain reading about Philando Castile. Tamir Rice still haunts me that we live in a country where a 12-year-old can be killed by an officer and no one is held accountable for that. That still haunts me to this day. So the fact that that doesn't even have to be on his radar, it's not even something he's even thinking of, and he's in law enforcement, is really concerning.
Marcus Cooper works at Park Ave Bike Shop and a cyclist who is here with a story of his own on this. And Marcus, I'll just sort of kind of open it up, you know, broadly to you to kind of share your experience about these kinds of issues, first of all. Go ahead.
Well, so this was some years back now, but I was detained by two police officers coming home from, you know, the East End area. At the time, I was living on the Irondequoit City border. So I was headed down Bay Street and, you know, was pulled over, you know. And at first, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought the lights were on to, you know, speed ahead or give me warning to let me know, you know, that we're going by you. So they slow down and I look back and I, you know, come to understand that they're pulling me over, which I'm kind of floored by because I'm on a bike. I have lights on my bike at this time. You know, both are working. And, you know, they proceeded to tell me that, you know, they essentially pulled me over because I fit the description of, and now, you know, I have, you know, they're noticing that I don't have a bell on my bike, and that's, you know, potentially a citation. You know, they asked if they could, you know, search my belongings, of which they found nothing. You know, but, you know, I think they really used the cycling as a, you know, sort of a scapegoat to pull me over is what it boiled down to, so.
Hmm. How did that impact you?
You know, I kind of took it in stride. I mean, to be quite honest and, you know, frank, it isn't the first time that I've been, you know, detained by police and, you know, things have gone worse, you know, prior. You know, a similar situation happened to me and a few friends in New York City. You know, at the time I was in college, you know, we were off on vacation, winter break. We were visiting a friend of who we went to school with across the street in her housing project. She lived on the top floor of the building, and, you know, we were hanging out just sort of in the hallway because her, you know, her folks were sleeping. It was a little later on in the evening. All of a sudden, police come charging up the steps, basically saying that, you know, we shouldn't be there. You know, we tell them that, you know, we're guests of this person, and they proceed to tell us, well, you know, you're not supposed to be on the roof of a New York City housing project. And I said, well, we're not on the roof of, you know, a New York City housing project. We're on the fifth floor of the building. And he said, well, you're in the landing that leads up to the roof of the housing project, and that's illegal. You know, proceeded to tell us that, you know, it smelled like weed, which we didn't have any weed. We weren't smoking, you know. Told us that, you know, that where we were soliciting prostitution from our friend, because there was three of us, three guys, and one lady. And, you know, asked us had we been soliciting prostitution, you know, had we been running a, you know, for lack of a better word, I don't know if I can say this on radio, but, you know, a gangbang. And and then they said, you know, we're going to arrest you tonight. And I said, well, what have we done wrong? And they said, you know, like we said, you know, you're trespassing. You're on the roof of a New York City housing project. And then when it was all said and done, they said, you know, normally we wouldn't arrest you for this, but it's the end of the month and we have a quota to meet. So you're going down tonight. And we spent the next 24 hours in jail. We went into, you know, the housing authority, you know, cell and proceeded on to central bookings and, you know, in Queens. So, well, this is an experience that I feel like, you know, is all too commonplace, you know, even when you're not doing anything truly criminal, you know, it's still something that, you know, happens that you expect. We were nothing but respectful to these officers. You know, that's something that my parents instilled in me, you know. In any instance that I've ever been in with a police officer, I've always been respectful, and I have had positive interactions, and I've had some go south like that, you know, so.
Before I grab our phone call, Daniel, you know, I mean, I know that's not anywhere close to the first story of its kind that you've heard, mm-hmm. as a criminal defense attorney, but how does that story hit you from various perspectives of the work that you're doing?
I mean, it's so painful. I have to be honest. I've been watching body cams that have to do with my cases, and it's been traumatizing to watch. One thing I tell people, and I would say to your listeners who don't have this experience, is to imagine that you're doing your daily jog in Four Corners in Pittsburgh, and you jog this way every day. And you get stopped by an officer. An officer asks you for your ID, asks you why you're driving so close to the street, why you're jogging so close to the street, ask if he can search you. And then imagine that happens to you once a month. Just imagine how suffocating that would be. And that's the reality for so many young Black men and young Black girls who live in the inner city. Jay-Z just wrote an article, and I love the title of the article, or the phrase he used in it, is that police officers are stalking Black Americans. And I thought that was just a powerful phrase to use, because what we have in the city that we don't have in the suburbs is this proactive type of policing, right? In the suburbs, the officers come when they're called. In the city, the officers are proactively engaging with people looking for things. They actually have a program where they were given funding to, you know, get rid of guns in the community. So it's called a give detail. And often you'll see officers write in the report on part of a give detail. So one of the officers who was on a give detail in one of my cases stopped my client because he was walking in the street, failing to use a sidewalk. So this is grant money and some taxpayer dollars that go to a program, and the stop is for failing to use the sidewalk. So I think taxpayers have to think about this. And is this where our money should be going? But for me, it's a painful thing. It's disheartening. And I'm trying to feel hopeful that there's a way out of this type of policing.
And I hear those stories a lot as well, Evan, with the young people that we work with. We have a young man working with us right now that was jailed for no bell on a bike. And I just know that one of the first things I said to him when he told me that story was, I know that that wouldn't happen to me. I know it wouldn't happen to my children. I don't know any white people who have been stopped for anything like that. And I know so many people of color, young people particularly, who have been stopped for those kinds of infractions. So, I mean, we need to look at that. I mean, you mentioned before with Todd Baxter's comment about, you know, what kind of training happens. I think society has been training us, you know, constantly. And that's the training that we've got to redo that's been happening on a regular basis around race.
And if I could just share some data, sure. We don't have the racial statistics of this data, but between 2012 and 2015, 74% of bicycle tickets were given to men under the age of 25. And like I said, that was not broken down into race.
For
no bell or no light on bike. But based on my experience, 5 years of being a public defender, I've never had one white person come before the court for a no bell on bike. And I've worked in the towns. I've worked in Clarkson and Pittsburgh.
Do all the towns, I'm totally ignorant on this, do the towns have those laws too?
They have town ordinances, and I'm not sure, you know, what each town might have.
I mean, like you brought up Pittsburgh, like this, has any
well,
white person in Pittsburgh
York
ever been pulled
state
over?
State law, you're supposed to have lights, front
okay,
and
okay.
rear, or reflectors, and you're supposed to have a belt, technically.
Thank you. I forgive my ignorance on this
so
issue.
So, you know, that varies town to town, though. I mean, you know, those are the New York State laws, but, like,
right.
towns can have their
okay.
own set of stuff that needs, you know.
No,
yeah, they may have separate ordinances, but, yes, it would be a violation of vehicle and traffic law, which is New York State.
So I think it would be interesting to find out, in the suburbs, how many people are pulled over or stopped.
Because I think in that same report that Danielle was just referring to, half of all the tickets between 2012 and 2015, pedestrian and bike related, were to 16 to 25 year old males that actually make up 8% of the city population.
I mean, I see people riding bikes at night in the suburbs all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've ever seen anybody stop for it. So let me do this. Just want to remind you why we're here, and then we'll take some of your phone calls, and you can call the program to weigh in on these or ask questions, share your experiences. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. On Friday, Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People are going to be at the Little Theater performing, and we'll tell you in our second half hour much more about what you can expect coming up at the Little. Danielle is not only a remarkable lead singer with her band there, but she's also a criminal defense attorney. Doug Ackley, Executive Director of Teen Empowerment, and Marcus Cooper is joining us as well, sharing his experience. He's a cyclist who works at Park Ave Bike Shop. And let me grab a couple of your phone calls, and then in our second half hour, we'll get into more of the show. And the phones are ringing. So let's start with Sam in Rochester, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Sam.
How you doing, Edwin? I really want to talk about this, so don't hang up on me.
No one's going to hang up on you, Sam. Go ahead.
I don't really think we're addressing the elephant in the room. And the elephant in the room is the reason they keep doing this is because they're exercising. They're trying to show African-Americans and Latinos, no matter how many laws you have, I still have control over you. You, and then some of them think that the African American and Latinos have too many rights, and then on top of that, you have young men who come from the suburbs who've been talked to all their life about African Americans and brown people and how they do this and how they do that, how they get away with this and how they get away with that, and you have people on, not all police now, but you have people on the police department who saying, well, when I get on the force, you're going to see there's going to be a change in that. We're going to stop all of that. And it's just to say to the African-American, no matter how you try to live, I'm going to show you I still have control and power over you. I'm going to keep you down, and I'm not going to let you ever get up. Now, if we're going to talk about it, let's really talk about this thing, because that's the elephant in the room. And there are people like that on the police department. That's where we must start at, too. There are people with mindsets like that on the police department. How do we correct that? We turn that around, and we'll see some of these little insignificant tickets and some of these insignificant stops. They'll stop. But that's not all police officers. I don't want you to say that. I think I'm talking about all police officers. There are just certain ones that are like that. I've seen them. I've seen them, how they interact with people.
Sam,
I want to hear your response.
Yeah, stay there, Sam. I'll start with Daniel Ponder on that. What do you think, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's the elephant. I'm like, yeah, absolutely, 100%. So I think the history of policing in the black community has always been to control the black population. And mm-hmm. So from the black codes when we were being stopped for nonsense till today, when we are still being stopped for nonsense. And I think people don't understand the historical relationship between police and the black community. And definitely one of the biggest issues is that we are getting white cops from small towns, from the suburbs, who have had no real relationships with people of color. And their first relationship is officer and suspect. And so the things that they may have learned have been on television, which is negative, or through the newspaper, which is negative. So they come from Parma to Conkey. And with this mindset, and I see this on body cams, because I'll see these 24, 25-year-old cops, and honestly, they're scared out of their mind. And you'll see the more fearful they are, the more the situation escalates. You can see it when even Philando Castile, you can see how scared that officer is. And the issue is they're scared of black men. And the people who are scared of you cannot be the people who are supposed to protect you. So I think, I think that's a huge issue. And I don't think it's an elephant. I think he's right on point.
Okay, Marcus Cooper?
Yeah, I don't think it's an elephant in the room at all. I mean, I think that's the issue, and that's the issue that people are trying to highlight. Like articles by Jay-Z, the talks of mass incarceration and just how all those systems relate to one another. I don't think that's necessarily the elephant in the room, but I mean, I think Danielle touched on a good point when, you take a look at freedmen when they were released from slavery. Well, then, a bunch of laws were enacted, basically vagrancy laws, because these people didn't have anywhere to go. And that's been the tradition of policing in America, basically, And if you look at people getting stopped for minor infractions like bells on bikes, it's completely relatable, So I don't think it's an elephant. I think that's, what we're addressing, but it's such a macro issue that you can't really, you talk about one sect of it, but you can't really, it's hard to talk about it in totality necessarily.
All right, hold on, Sam. Stay there because I want to ask Doug Ackley. Doug mentioned earlier, as the executive director of Teen Empowerment, you've seen interactions among some of the teens who work for TE with police officers, and some have been what you think are appropriate, upstanding on all sides, exactly how it should have gone down, and then some that, you know, you were deeply bothered by. And Sam is raising the point that, you know, we have to find a way to reduce the number, in his words, of officers who are causing issues in these departments. Do you have any thoughts on how that would happen?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that need to happen. I do think that we need to continue to look at how we recruit, how we train officers. But I think we need to continue to have this dialogue about race and what it means. And because I think that there are ways that things continue to get justified in terms of policing. You know, we've got to do it because of this, or because there's a lot of crime over here because of this. And I think that, you know, what Danielle said is there's a fear of young people of color. I think that we need to be able to hold officers accountable and the same way that we hold everybody else accountable in our community. And I think that's a piece that needs to be on the table as well. I think that there are names of officers that are out there all the time that young people continue to talk about over and over and over again. And I've seen as well. And they continue to end up back out on the street. I mean, I had one officer who I was walking over at Wilson High School, and there was this is a couple years ago, and there's about to be a little altercation. And it actually never happened. There were some families who showed up and all this stuff happened, but it was a lot of people outside. It was one of those scenes that I think we've seen sometimes. And I happened to be walking by this officer who was white, and I'm white. And he didn't know why I was there, didn't know who I was, and didn't know that I work with young people in the community, and didn't know how many folks that were involved in this that I know or had talked to and all this stuff. Just had no idea who I am. Just walked right by me, looked at me, and said, "I hate these effing kids." And I said, "This guy's a police officer." Like that, I mean, just looked at me, assuming that I'm gonna maybe respond with some kind of acknowledgement, you know, whether he wanted a Me Too or, you know, looked at me and maybe we share whiteness and whatever we shared in that moment, that he thought he could say that to me. But that's deeply disturbing, and that's not an isolated incident.
Sam, go ahead.
Edmund, now I want to leave this on a positive note. I live in Gates, and I sit out front and I wave at people and I pray for people, and because I'm a minister. But one of the police officers here didn't see me and my dog out there for a while, and so we were sitting out front, and the police officer came by. And he says, and he stops, and he says, "Now, I haven't seen you out here waving," and says, "Are you all right? Have you been sick?" And that really touched me, that he would be that concerned, that he would stop by my house, didn't have to, and ask me if I was all right. Now that's the kind of policing that we need in for things to turn around. And if we don't get that kind of policing, where people can care about each other, not look at the color, but look at the content of their character, as Martin Luther King said, and judge people on their character, you know, not by the color of their skin. And you were talking about, how do we address this with the police officer? Do you know police officers come on the police force, they get a psychological evaluation in the beginning of their career. They never get another one unless somebody recommends that they have one or they ask for one. Now, to me, that's a little crazy for something, because you got to think of all that police officers encounter over the year. He shouldn't have to request it. They should have it automatically, where they come in, they talk to these officers, ask them, "Are you going through anything? Is something happening at home? This is all confidential. This is all purpose. And if it is something, let's address it so that you don't wind up killing someone needlessly." That's how we need to do that.
All right, Sam, thank you. I've got to get to other. I appreciate that, Sam. Danielle, what do you make of the idea of reevaluating at times?
Say it again?
For psychological, and Sam thinks we should get back to that at times.
Yeah, I think he makes an excellent point. I also think that the community should have a say on who polices them. I don't know why it's just a foreign idea that the people who are paying tax dollars should have some input. And actually, I could be wrong. Maybe the interview process includes community members, but I don't think it does. But why isn't the community a part of that? Officers play such a huge role in their daily lives, and we should have a bigger say in who polices us.
I am way late for a break. I want to read a quick email. We'll get to our only break, and we're going to come right back to your calls. And but this comes from Natalie. It says, "Hi, Evan. I'm a white woman in my 30s working in academia. I smoke pot. I have a lot of white friends who also smoke pot. I am seen as a progressive liberal hippie. I even joke about it with one of my cop neighbors. And then last year, one of my black male students suddenly stopped coming to class. I finally found out he was pulled over for speeding and then arrested because the cop smelled marijuana. He ended up dropping out of school. His life changed forever for doing something I'm oftentimes commended for. I'm seen as a progressive hippie simply because he is black and I'm white. That was a huge wake-up call to my white privilege and the ways in which people of color are criminalized drastically disproportionately to white people." Mm. That comes from Natalie. Natalie, thanks for sharing that email. Let's go ahead and get a break. I want to tell you, producer Megan Mack sends me a note saying there are 11 seats left for the concert if you want to go on Friday, December 1st. There are 11 tickets that you can get right now, and if you wait, you will not be able to go. $25 in advance. Go to thelittle.org. Did you know that, by the way? Tickets are...
I just saw that.
Okay,
I was
whoa. Okay. So it's going to sell out, but you might as well get tickets now. The Little Theater, this Friday, December 1st. The show starts at 8:30. Doors open at 7:30. Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People for The Love of Justice, A Soulful Journey of Love in All Forms. We'll talk more with Danielle about that, and we'll take more of your calls if we come back right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, BuzzFeed is not making as much money as they thought, and they're supposed to be a hot media property. So what do we tell aspiring young journalists about their industry that in some forms is dying? We'll talk about the future of journalism. Then in our second hour, New York State wants to use local farms more often. Farmers say the standards make that tough. We'll talk about that dissonance on Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hour is flying by here. And before I grab some more of your phone calls, so if you're on the line, stay there, please. Daniel Ponder, I know your show is going to sell out on Friday. It's going to sell out. And of course it is at The Little. It's a great place for a show. It's called For the Love of Justice, A Soulful Journey of Love in All Forms. And why don't you let our listeners know a little bit about what you're hoping to bring to them on Friday?
So what I've been, we did this show last year, and we're filming this show this year because I'm hoping to make this show international. My hope, Evan, I'm going to say it here, is to be on Terry Gross one day. Not that you're not good enough, but...
I don't know how to take this.
I really want to, you know, make this a national show.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the whole concept behind it is, you know, to let love be the foundation in which we talk about justice. I don't want to argue with people on Facebook. I don't want to go back and forth and say mean things to people, but I really want to speak in the language of love. So the love in three forms, it really talks about, we do a little bit about romantic love, and then we do about love for yourself, personal liberation. And then there's love for others. And that's what justice is. Justice is what love looks like in public. And so it's a beautiful show. But I think people want to think of themselves as compassionate. Does this music mean I'm over? What does
no.
this music mean?
No, no. Just It just means you're talking about your music. So we thought
I'm like,
we'd
is
hear
this
a little
the wrapping up music?
No, it's your music. Not at all. This is
but
the
I just
want to
say this
know.
Last piece yeah. is that people think of themselves as loving people, compassionate people. If you say to someone, are you a loving person? They'll say, yeah, I'm a loving person. But then how do loving and compassionate people exist in a country with the highest incarceration rate? How do loving and compassionate people exist in a city that stops young people and jail them for not having a light on their bike? There's some cognitive dissonance going on. Either we are loving and compassionate or we're not. And our criminal justice system, if it reflects us, and if the Rochester Police Department is a reflection of the taxpayers, then that's not sending a message of love and compassion. We're sending a message of love, a message of punishment. A punishment of fear, of irrational thinking. So I really am interested in grounding us in love. And from officers to, you know, judges to whatever, what does a criminal justice system look like when the foundation is love?
Well, that's why you should be there on Friday. But I said there are 11 tickets left like 5 minutes ago. I bet you there's like four. Thelittle.org. Get seats now, and you can be there on Friday night for that. By the way, Pete on Twitter, Pete Nabosny from used to be with the Center for Governmental Research, and he is with the Children's Agenda now, but he also is a board member of Reconnect Rochester, and they put together an outstanding film recently on the impacts of transportation and poverty. Pete on Twitter says, East Rochester issued 5 tickets total to bicyclists and pedestrians from 2012 to 2015. Mm. Brighton issued a total of 8 in that time. So three plus years, 2 different suburbs, a total of 13 tickets total. That would not be the case.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me, though, because, I mean, I work out there. I cycle through those areas all the time. I'm in Vicknor. I'm in East Rochester. I'm in, you know, Bloomfield. Like, I ride out there. Like, there's no police presence out there. You know, like, there's no one to ticket people. You know what I mean? Like she said,
yeah,
police
no
only come when
policing.
People when they're called, you know? There's not, you know, a police officer that's, you know,
but
mandated,
I've seen people riding
mandated
without,
to...
without a light or without bells in those areas.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
And nothing happens.
No, not at all.
They're not actively policing those
right,
communities.
Exactly.
They're not stalking the members of those communities. If that was happening, it would be a national outrage and the phones would be blowing up and, you know, people would be protesting by the millions. If little white boys riding their bike in Pittsburgh Four Corners were being stopped every other week by an officer, can you imagine the outrage? So that's why we say Black Lives Matter, because when there's no outrage for what's happening in our community, it sends a message that our lives don't matter, right?
Here's some outrage. Jim writes to us and says, "Hi, Evan. Thanks for keeping this important issue an ongoing focus on your show. It continues to disturb me that despite the abundant evidence, I find myself still having to debate that racial profiling actually exists in this country. And to hear Marcus's story about his encounter in New York City makes me absolutely sick." That's from Jim. I know, Jim. I don't know what else to say. I mean, Marcus, are you feeling any more optimism yourself? I mean, you've been through a lot yourself. Do you see any change at all? Danielle says from a work perspective in terms of the clients and the kinds of encounters she has in the community, there hasn't essentially been change there. Do you sense any change? How are you feeling?
I mean, I'm always a hopeful and optimistic person mm-hmm. by nature. So I would say in that regard, I'm always hopeful. But, you know, I don't see any immediate change, you know. For instance, I was just talking to a friend who was up visiting from New York City, and he was like, "Stop and frisk still goes on all the time in my neighborhood." He was like, "It hasn't changed at all." He was like, "You know, it came down that they were stop and frisk, but it didn't, you know." And that's not, you know, any real data that anyone can go on, but that's a perspective, you know. And you know, I like, you know, we're talking about now. I don't think that there's any real, you know, change in what's been happening. I think the discourse is positive. I think that people are having these conversations is a good thing. But, you know, immediate change or, you know, even slow change. I mean, this has been something that's kind of been in the national scope for a long time, you know, a few years now. And haven't seen any real change in that regard, you know.
Now let me get Wilma in Rochester, who's been waiting on the phone. Go ahead, Wilma.
Hi, I just wanted to say that we don't have to look to Brighton or Pittsburgh to see the difference in terms of who's being targeted with these broken window ways of engaging for law enforcement. We can look at the north side of Rochester and the south side of Rochester. In my neighborhood, which happens to be on the south side of Rochester, people ride their bicycles with no bells, no lights, no helmets, and, you know, they break vehicle traffic laws. So I think you could just look at where the tickets are given, and you could probably make a case. I know sometime in the past there was a look at how records are kept in Rochester, and they don't keep anything that would allow you to, they don't keep the records in enough detail that would allow you to do the kind of research that was done in New York City that put a stop to so much stop and frisk. But I had a second point and or question for Doug and Danielle, and that is, you're talking a lot about what happens with young black men. Can you talk about what happens with criminal justice and women of color? Because I know that we often get overlooked when the discussion comes to things like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, women of color, Daniel Ponder.
So I think there are definitely some unique charges that are specifically made for women of color. Wilma, I think one of the ones that it seems is most disheartening to me is endangering the welfare of a child, which is a very broad charge that is often used. I had a client who was in her backyard on the phone. She lived in an apartment building, and her child, who was 4 years old, ended up in the hallway at some point. So a neighbor called an officer because the child was in the hallway. She was arrested for endangering the welfare of her child, even though she told the officer she's on the phone. Her mother was sick at the time. She was on the phone in the backyard. The officer charged her, arrested her. Some judges will even issue order of protection, so you won't even be able to see your kids for this small misdemeanor offense. Now, Wilma, I know and you know, if this woman was a white woman who lived anywhere and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, officer, I was in the backyard," she would not be arrested for endangering the welfare of the child. But it goes back to the perception that they have of black women, specifically black mothers, and is that they are inherently bad mothers. So when you believe someone is inherently a bad mother, it's easy to arrest them for the endangering the welfare of the child, and it's easy to give them an order of protection that separates them from that child, because you know what? They're not good mothers anyway. So officers and judges and district attorneys are carrying perceptions of people that have been codified in their psyche since the beginning of this country. And that perception affects the charges that they place on people, whether people are incarcerated or not. But that's just one specific example, the endangering welfare of a child, that seems to be a charge that is for black mothers.
Wilma, you want to follow that up? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I know at one point there was a study by DHS where they showed that more children are put in foster homes, more children of color are put in foster homes. And when they drilled down, it was related to what Danielle's talking about. And I thought maybe things had gotten better. Do you see an improvement over time, Danielle?
You know, Wilma, I'll say no, but once again, I am going based on my 5 years of experience in the office.
Uh-huh.
I'm still seeing endangering welfares of a child based on very small things, you know, going to the backyard on the phone, or a mother who has to go to work, or leaving your child somewhere for 5 minutes. We are seeing these charges still. I don't know if the data would come down differently, but I'm not sure.
I got a tweet from DJ Ali Khan, who I'm going to read in a second. I'll have all of our guests respond to as we get ready to wrap the hour. But real quick, this is not meant to be a cheap shot, but I want to follow up with you because of your expertise and my ignorance on this subject.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about an officer shows up and a mom is in the backyard on the phone, and all of a sudden there is an arrest in that situation.
Yes.
This is not meant to be a cheap shot about a well-publicized story, but Greece and Rochester PD are trying to figure out what happened on Thanksgiving night, in which an off-duty investigator apparently possibly drove drunk with a three-year-old, gets left in a bed in a house when no one is there. And what we've heard from Greece Police Chief Phelan is, you know, we'll still investigate, and if there's probable cause, then we'll do something. But, you know, we haven't seen probable cause to arrest anybody. Does that make sense to you? I mean, does that line up with the kind of level of probable cause you see?
You know, I see so little investigation in my case. I'm just shocked that they're investigating. Usually they arrest and then they ask questions later. Doug has a former YO who just spent 6 months, if you want to.
Yeah, I was going to say that's, I think, another big issue that would be worthwhile to take on too, Evan, is the whole, you know, I think that it's act and then ask questions and try to figure out later. And I think what that means to people of color who are arrested is that they're sitting in jail for long periods of time. And we know that the statistics came out. The city newspaper did a big article on that. It was disproportionately people of color who are arrested and given jail time with bail that they can't afford, and so end up sitting in jail. That oftentimes means losing jobs, you know, families breaking up, losing apartments. All kinds of things take place when somebody's in jail. I just had a young man who spent 6 months in jail for a situation that he was just acquitted of because they got video that showed that he didn't do what they said he did, but he stayed in jail for 6 months. He lost 6 months of his life, and you know, I think that that is, it's not uncommon.
Well, let me just, in about our last minute, DJ Ali Khan said, appreciating today's episode, Evan, can you ask your guests about their thoughts on community mechanisms for greater accountability? Marcus Cooper, you've gone through a lot. What do you think can make everyone more accountable so that there is more actual justice?
I mean, a community review board is always a good thing. I mean, I think that's a suggestion that's been put out into the, you know, into the sphere a lot. And, you know, I don't see too many municipalities that are, you know, have been receptive to it. It seems like something that, you know, well, we handle our dirt in-house type of thing. And, you know, but I think that could be one mechanism that could certainly, you know, help, you know, push things forward.
Okay. 30 seconds, Danielle. Your thoughts?
I agree with him. A civilian review board. Shout out to Ted Forsyth, Barbara Lackaware, and people who are, have been working on that. Shame on our city council if they do not get this into place. A civilian review board with subpoena power. I also think the community should have a say in who is policing them. I also think that officers, before they step in Conkey Avenue D, should do a year of community service and a nonprofit where they serve and engage and interact with youth of color before they see them as suspects.
Interesting. That's a proposal. I'd be fascinated to hear what Chief Simonelli and others say about a proposal like that. You know, just another way to sort of build bridges and hopefully, as Daniel Ponder has told us, increase the quantity of love in the world in real ways. But a lot of it's on people who have privilege and advantage, I think. Probably to keep recognizing it, talking about it, and making sure we understand what all of that means. So this is Learn How to Love to close the hour. There's a few tickets left, we think, if you go to thelittle.org for Friday night with Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People at The Little. Doug, Marcus, Danielle, thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You. Appreciate
all right, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Connections.
This program is a production of WXXI.